Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is the Sound Health Option Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Sherry Edwards is in the lab again, really working on that portal for the Sound Health Options portal online. It's amazing. It's really wonderful to have access to software directly online. Just make a recording, upload it, and it's there, and you have your reports all available. It's really nice. So, good morning, everybody. Today is going to be a great show with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Really spicy conversation regarding vaccine choices. I'll remind everybody, because you're going to want to take notes and or send this on to your friends and people who think they, you know, are on one side or the other. Either side, it's a great conversation. And that you will be able to find this show about 10 to 15 minutes after the show ends. You'll be able to go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and then click on the archives tab, and there will be a player there with the last 5 shows. And you can also go to any of your podcast aggregating platforms, meaning iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Cast or any of those, and search for Sherry Edwards and find the almost now 500 shows. And this show, Stitcher and Pocket Cast, is particularly easy to share shows. And this is really one of those shows that I think you're going to want to tell your friends and re-listen to, because Dr. Sherry is so filled with amazing information. And it's really just, it's all, you know, amazing. The times we are in are really quite extraordinary. And with that, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is an outspoken advocate for free choice in healthcare, including the right to refuse vaccinations. As an internationally known speaker, she's highly sought after for her ability to present scientifically sound information regarding vaccination hazard and warnings that are rarely portrayed by conventional medicine. Most importantly, she offers hope through her unique treatments offered at Tenpenny Integrative Medical Center for those who have been vaccine injured. Dr. Tenpenny is also an expert on women's breast health and the use of iodine for disease. Committed to the wellness and health of her patients, Dr. Tenpenny has created an array of informational CDs and DVDs to educate her patients and others interested in personal health and wellness. Educational products addressing these concerns, as well as the latest information on vaccination, are available by going to drtenpenny.com. As an author, Dr. Tenpenny has written 2 best-selling books, Foul, Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think, and Saying No to Vaccines, A Resource Guide for All Ages. She's a contributing author to the textbook Food and Nutrition and Disease Management and the book Vaccine Epidemic, How Corporate Greed, Biased Science, and Coercive Government Threaten Our Human Rights, Our Health, and Our Children. Dr. Tenpenny joins us in conversation on vaccine choices, fact versus fiction. Where do you think our health would be today if we were to have invested in building strong immune systems with children's diets and healthy microbiomes? In addition, of course, getting the world clean water.
Oh, I think that we would be so much further ahead. It's unbelievable. I mean, I believe that if we would have invested in clean water technologies all over the world, electricity, which then would be applied to refrigeration so that food could be preserved and would not be left out for flies and other sort of pathogens to land on it, even in third world countries, I think it would be marvelous. In fact, there was a paper that came out that was published in, I believe it was 2004, by a couple of researchers from Harvard, that said that clean water technologies from the latest part of the 18th century through the 1930s and on into about the 1960s, that clean water technology was the most important advancement in public health that had ever been created.
I just had to ask, because I thought that would be your answer, that, you know, we'd be healthier. I mean, just actually healthier. What a shock.
Yeah, I mean, it's instead of Rotary International investing up to $6 billion over the last 20 or 30 years in trying to eliminate the polio virus from around the world, if they would have invested that same amount of money into hygiene, sewage treatment plants, potable water, education, providing electricity, the entire world would be in a better place.
Richard is a staunch environmentalist and love of Mother Nature. He's with you. So am I when you look at these things like Flint, Michigan, and that kind of thing. But I live out in a farm and we have our own spring well, so it doesn't hit me so bad. But I want to sort of move into a direction that I don't think a lot of people know about, because I think a lot of the information has been squashed. I followed Dr. Molden for a lot of years and his research on before and after vaccines and what it did to the brain. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know you've worked with him some.
Yeah, he had a technology that he developed that actually looked in slow motion the lateral and vertical eye movements. And his premise was that because of the aluminum and the other sort of toxicities that were within the vaccine, that it increased the hypercoagulability within the blood vessels. And because we made the blood more sticky, we were creating little bitty mini strokes that were actually happening in the brain, and that they were affecting the nerves that went to the eyes. And as we affected those nerves that went to the eyes, you could document the brain damage that was happening after a vaccine by the changes in the horizontal and vertical movements of the eyes. And that his research project was, I think, just getting started when, unfortunately, he passed away. And it would be marvelous if someone would pick up the baton and move that forward and continue to do that level of investigation.
Here at the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, we have a computer program that we use to see pre and post vaccine. And one of the things that we found consistently was this micro stroke in the body. And that's what connected me to Dr. Molden's work. I still believe that that's what's going on, and agree with him wholeheartedly, even though I don't have his medical background, which was incredible. So we've picked up some of this, and one of the things we're finding is the ability to process quercetin is really intimately involved with this. And when I wrote to the Bill Gates Foundation and told them what we had found, I got nothing back but nasty letters about nutballs like you, and I mean, they didn't say it in that way, but that's what they meant. And when I looked at that letter and who wrote it, it was somebody who had previously worked for a vaccine company. So can you talk a little bit about Big Pharma and vaccines and how we got into this position in the first place that says vaccines are okay and they don't cause any damage, but we'll pay all this money if there is damage? It's just kind of crazy.
You know, the issue is that I think that you were a brave woman to contact the Gates Foundation. I really do. I think that you were, because it doesn't surprise me that you got the answer back that you did. I mean, the Gates Foundation in 2010 put up $750 million to start what was called the Decade of Vaccines, which was between 2010 and ongoing through 2020. And to date, they have put in over $6.1 billion into vaccinating the world. So they have absolutely no interest whatsoever in finding that the vaccines cause any problem or finding any other way to keep anyone else in the world safe other than by vaccinating them. So the Gates Foundation and UNICEF, the World Health Organization, Gavi, the United Nations, all of these globalist societies are literally synergistically doing whatever they can to vaccinate the entire world.
Do you have problems with vaccines? I want to bring in your books and what you're trying to teach people with your books. So can you tell us about your stance?
Well, I started investigating the problems associated with vaccines in September of 2000. And after more than 20,000 hours, you know, far beyond 20,000 hours worth of investigation, find that vaccines are not safe. They do not protect you. They do cause harm. They can cause autoimmune diseases, neurological problems, and even in some patients and some people, death. And that they, and I believe that it's a very outdated technology, and it's a sad state of science and healthcare and medicine that by nearly 2017 we have not come up with some better technology to promote immune system health, to promote overall health and wellness, other than injecting children and adults with substances of known toxic value and can even known carcinogens. I think it's an abject failure of science, and it has nothing to do with health and everything to do with money and economics.
So it's the what I like to call follow the money syndrome, it seems like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there are now at least 140 vaccines in the developmental pipeline. If you include the DNA vaccines to manipulate our genetics and the tumor vaccines for treatment of cancer, there's over 300 vaccines in the developmental pipeline. And in the entire sector of the pharmaceutical industry, the vaccine sector is currently the smallest sector and it's approaching $50 billion a year. It's been the only sector in the only section in the vaccine industry. I'm sorry. It's been the only sector in the pharmaceutical industry that has experienced double digit growth over the last 5 to 7 years. And it's very much about making people customers for life. If I inject 100 people with vaccines, and at least 50% of them have some sort of a development of a side effect, whether it's allergies or asthma, eczema, ADD, ADHD, autoimmune diseases, neurological problems, well, then that's just a really great thing for the pharmaceutical industry, because now they have another entire book business to use in terms of selling more drugs and increasing their stock prices to the benefit of their shareholders.
And I have a sort of a sideways question. Do you think that vaccines were always this dirty? It almost seems like vaccines at this point are kind of like what we do when we're fracking. There's, you know, 300 and some odd chemicals involved in fracking, pumping toxins into the earth under the guise of getting gas out. So were vaccines always a dirty product, or have they become dirtier as they make more and add more things to them?
No, they've always been a filthy, dirty product. In fact, you know, with the first vaccine that was widely used was the smallpox vaccine, which was developed in 1799. And it was developed by taking cowpox or a weakened smallpox virus, scraping them into the belly of cows and calves, and then harvesting the pus from those infected spots or from the bottoms of the hooves of cows and horses, and then creating an unsterile knife and putting slash marks into the side of the mother, and then taking that pus and slathering that across those lacerated places on the side of her arm. And then as that began to fester and ooze and become an area of inoculation, they would scrape that off and inject it into the arms of infants. So from the very beginning, we had no concept of immune system. We had no concept of bacteria and infections. It was a very filthy industry, and it was fraught with injustices where in the UK where the physicians and the vaccine manufacturers were all getting money from the government to promote this vaccination program. And so from its very inception, there has been this incestual relationship between healthcare providers, vaccine manufacturers, and the government. And it's always been about the money. And so we had a very dirty, filthy technology from the beginning, and it hasn't changed much all the way through the years. I think a lot of people think that a vaccine, when they think about a vaccine vial, and they wonder, think about what's in that vial that's being the solution that is being drawn up into the syringe and then injected into the arm, that they think there is some weakened viruses, maybe some tiny dead parts of bacteria, and a little sterile water. And that's all that's in that solution that then gets injected into your system. But there are more than 63 different chemicals in those solutions of all those different vaccines. Some of them are known carcinogens. There's aluminum, there's mercury, there's polysorbate 80 that can cause anaphylaxis. There's traces of formaldehyde. There are animal cells, human DNA, insect DNA that is now being used for some of the newer flu shots. And all of those cell particles end up inside of those vaccine vials. And that's why I've often said that what's in that vial is vile.
I can't help but laugh. It's gross and it's, yeah, it makes me laugh. It makes me flash back to, I'm old enough that when I was in elementary school, I remember being in line to go into the cafeteria. This obviously, I'll use this intentionally, stuck with me. Standing in the line to go into the cafeteria. This is back when we actually had cafeterias and you had, you know, women with hairnets on cooking, you know, real food. And we were lined up to go into the cafeteria. And as you were going in, there was a nurse sitting there in full nurse outfit with a glass hypodermic jamming you in the arm, just like it was Tuesday. You know, there was no announcement. There was no anything. It just happened. Boom. And then you went and had lunch. And so those, I had a fantasy until this moment that perhaps those vaccines were slightly cleaner than what's now. But there's still, you know, help us scrapings in a certain way, or they were then, and now they're, you know, it's just, it's all stunningly horrific.
It is stunningly horrific, and I think that's a really good phrase to put out there, that in this day and age, I don't see how anyone could just volunteer their children or voluntarily roll up their arm and just accept whatever the government thinks should be injected into your body without doing any sort of research or identification. You know, when I started this back in September of 2000, there were very few resources. The internet really wasn't what it is today. We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have Instagram. Google was just getting started. You really didn't have the resources that you have now. Someone told me not too long ago that there were over 600 anti-vaccine Facebook pages. If you go out to Amazon, you can find dozens of books that show problems associated with vaccines. You can search the pediatric infectious disease journals. You have access to many different things online. And so access to information about problems associated with vaccines today is all you have to do is pull your head up out of your handheld long enough to look around and you can find it if you want to see it. We have a website called vaccineresearchlibrary.com that has hundreds of articles, probably closer to 1,000 articles now, of abstracts and links to articles from the mainstream medical journals showing problems associated with vaccines. So anyone who doesn't do their research before they volunteer their arm or their children to be injected by these vial things coming through the vial, I think they should be charged with negligence. And I'm hoping that somewhere in my lifetime, that will be considered child abuse.
Well, and there's no, I think what a part of, I'm not sure if this is stunning or horrific. To me, is that there's an environmental attorney who also does a lot of work in the health realms, Carolyn Raffensperger, came up with the term the precautionary principle. It really is the let's do everything that we're going to do to the environment, which fits to me right in here with vaccines. Let's actually take on the precautionary principle. Let's actually see if this is okay. Let's not do it and then see what happens with the results to everything or everybody. Let's actually have a little like, let's really look at this. And there's none of that. There's absolutely none of that. It just, oh, okay. So what I'm moving toward is I'm in California. So I now have no choice because of the post-Governor Brown SB 277 mandate that if you're a healthcare worker, and I know a number of healthcare workers that are fighting this now, you have to get vaccinated. So how do we, is there a way we can regain our control? I mean, how, what do we do?
Well, two things about SB 277. I know that there are some behind-the-scenes lawsuits that are happening, many of them actually, that are looking at the constitutionality of that law. And that for your listeners who may not know what that is, this was the law that was passed about 2 years ago, SB 277, that took away the right of you as a parent to refuse vaccines for your children. California had always been a philosophical exemption state, which meant you looked at the risk of the vaccine versus the risk of the illness. You were willing to support your child and take care of them and protect them in other ways to keep them healthy rather than injecting things into them that could cause harm. Well, SB 277 took away your right to do that. And it's already been published across the country in public health literature that should become the model legislation for all 50 states. So I know that we just dodged a bullet here in Ohio just this last week, that there was a bill that was supposed to be discussed on Monday of taking away the philosophical exemption here in Ohio, and it got taken off the agenda by pressure that was put on by the Ohio Advocates for Medical Freedom and all of the people that we have rallied in the state of Ohio to retain our right to refuse, because we have a similar philosophical exemption in Ohio as California used to have. So everyone needs to wake up and understand that there is case precedence for this that goes all the way back to Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1905 that was passed by the U.S. Supreme Court that said that the rights of the individual needs to be subjugated to the right of the greater good at the whim of public health. And that's, you know, not exactly what the court case said, but I think that, Richard, you would probably agree that that sort of sums it up. But we need to get people active and involved now, because people only get involved with something that could harm them after it's too late to say, I don't want to do that anymore. And as you know, it takes a lot to pass a law, but it takes 10 times more to change or repeal a law after it's been passed. And I think that now is the time, with this, you know, change of administration that's coming into play, with a whole new government that's coming into play. And, you know, now we have won a lot of seats across the country, and that, you know, really is now is the time more than ever to be involved with making sure that you retain your right to refuse.
Here in Ohio, where I live also, Dr. Tenpenny, in the southern part, in our county, they have put teachers under child care workers so they can mandate teachers get vaccines. And one of the things that the doctors are doing here is if you will not get a vaccine, they can't kick you out of their practice, but they'll just, you get there and they'll delay you and say the doctor's not in. And after three or four times of that, people just drop out. And I asked one of my doctor friends about that, and they said it's because there's a mandate through the government, through Obamacare, that if you don't have a certain amount of your people in the hospital and workers, even accountants and people who never come in contact with patients, that if you don't have all of those people vaccinated, I think it was 99% or something, that you will not get paid anything from the government on any issue. Can you elaborate on that or tell us if that's true or not? It's not?
No. Not even a little bit. It's and part of what the issue is not it has nothing to do with Obamacare and requirements for getting a certain percentage of the population vaccinated. What it really comes down to is that Blue Cross Blue Shield will pay physicians, particularly pediatrician offices, $400 per child if 63% of the kids in their practice are fully vaccinated with 10 vaccines. So it has nothing, I mean, that's out of the Blue Cross Blue Shield handbook that came out at the beginning of this year. It really has nothing to do with Obamacare, nothing to do with the fact that there's none of that, nothing. I don't even know, that's the first I've ever heard it, and it's absolutely not true.
Okay, that's good to know. I heard Elizabeth Warren talk about, on the House floor, or wherever she's from in Congress, that we need this herd mentality, and if some people get hurt by it, that's just too bad. With this new administration, do you think there's going to be any changes in that attitude?
No, I absolutely do think that there's a problem, or that it's going to be different. I know that Dr. Andy Wakefield and Del Bigtree of the Vax movie have actually met President-elect Trump personally, and I know that he does not believe in vaccine mandates, and I do think that that's going to change dramatically.
Wait, that is wonderful. Your books are all so down to earth for parents. Can you suggest one or two of your books that would help us get through this adult mandated vaccine push?
It's interesting. My book, Saying No to Vaccines, really isn't about the adult vaccination push. It's really about telling parents about the 25 most common reasons people think you should vaccinate and how to refute those questions. And that's my book, Saying No to Vaccines. I'm actually in the process right now. I'm hoping to have it done within the next couple of months of writing a new book called They're Coming After You Next, The Adult Vaccine Mandate. And so a lot of times when people hear these discussions or interviews on vaccines, they sort of raise half of an ear because it might be interesting to them, but they feel like, well, their kids are past, school age, and they've got grandkids that are on their way, but their kids aren't really going to listen to them, and so they don't really pay attention. But the next big round of vaccines that are actually coming are towards adolescents and adults. And there are currently 13 vaccines that are approved for adults. And like I mentioned before, there is at least 140 in the vaccine pipeline. And the adult vaccine mandate that was the National Adult Vaccination Plan that was released in February of 2015, it actually says in there that the goal is to vaccinate every adult in the country with every currently licensed vaccine and any licensed vaccine that may be created in the future.
Wow.
So, that's a quote. That's actually a quote right off of the adult vaccination plan. There's a global vaccination plan. There's a national vaccination plan. And both of them are supported through the decade of vaccines, which is through 2020. And Healthy People 2020 is put into place, and one of its stated goals, is to have an 85 to 90% vaccination rate of all people in the country by the end of this decade. And they're well on their way. I mean, they've it's all going to be tracked, monitored, and watched through electronic medical records. And most of because the electronic medical records really aren't private, and all of the information that's within them is, in one way or another, given back to the government.
You've taken my breath away, which is hard to do. You made me stop talking.
Well, you know, how that all started with electronic medical records was when they instituted Obamacare in 2010. And, you know, they sold this bill of goods to physicians, telling them that in order for them to get paid, particularly through Medicare and Medicaid, they needed to have electronic medical records and electronic billing. The problem was that the introduction of the to purchase the Medicaid module for electronic billing was about $43,000 per physician in an office. So if you had five physicians, you had to pay $43,000 times five. And to participate in the Medicare module for billing, it was $62,000 per physician. So, you know, when you add that all up, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars just to institute electronic medical records. And so, of course, nobody was going to do it because, you know, physicians' practices, you're actually a small business, and where were you ever going to recoup that money? And so the government came along and said, well, not a problem. We'll do this for you. We'll pay for all of it. And in exchange for that, we just want you to give us all the data. And there are over 2,000 different entities and organizations that are given the privilege of being able to access that blinded data with inside those electronic medical records. And each year, more and more of those records were required to be given over to the government. And beginning in 2016, one of the data points that needed to be given over to the government was vaccination status. And the vaccination status went into a program called IIS, which is your local and regional vaccine registry database. And it's an opt-out system, which means that you are automatically put into the system unless you know enough about it and can go to your local health department and to the registries and take yourself out. And once you're in permanently, and it's a cradle to grave tracking mechanism for people's vaccination records and of all other types of medical data that they are collecting on people.
This, one of the stupid things they asked me during that gathering was, one, if I had a gun, how many were they registered? How many times I had sex per week? I mean, it was stuff on there that was none of their business.
And that's all tracked and all collated, and they need to, so that people know where all of those, where everybody is and where all those things are.
Well, I just lied to them up and down.
Good for you.
And is there, so back to that, back to the health department, is there something we can do as individuals? Can we go to our local health department, whatever, I'm not even sure what that means, but can we go to our local health department and have ourselves taken out of that registry? But once we're in?
I believe that you can. You have to know where those local registries are. And I don't know the list of those off the top of my head. And I also know that once you know this information, you can request that your physician not participate with your record. Now, the physician doesn't have to say, okay, fine. They can say, no, sorry, in order for me to get my bonuses, I have to turn in this information. But at least if you know and you have the right to ask for them to not submit your data and to not participate. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't hold true for hospital systems. Hospital systems are required to submit the information, and you don't have any say about it at all. And those are the rules. Those are the HIPAA rules, and that comes right off of government websites, the things that I'm mentioning to you now.
And do you think that if we were involved in a hospital incident and that registry was put in, can we have that then stopped or removed, or is that, do you know if that's possible?
It's my understanding that you don't have anything to say about the hospital, but that you do have the right to have a discussion with your physician and to not have your records be submitted through your personal electronic medical records in a physician's office. Now, I would say, just in a sort of a pseudo defensive position, I suspect that many of the physicians don't even know that this is going on, that this is an administrative function, something that's going on probably through whoever does their billing and things. And they may not even have any idea to the level to which this privacy is being breached by the government.
And do you feel that if a physician, like I have a physician that I know I could go speak with her and she would be interested in this, do you have to use the word suspect that if she was choosing to do that, that she would then possibly get in trouble because she would be flagged as somebody who's not submitting patient's information?
I highly doubt it, because it would be on a onesie twosie perspective.
Right.
I mean, if she's got 3,000 patients in her database and one or two people hear this interview or read my book when it gets done and they go in and request it, I don't think that there'll be a problem. I think that if suddenly thousands of people went in and asked that, you know, it might raise some red flags. But I don't think on an individual basis it will. But that's just my opinion.
I want to go sideways slightly. We got information that the CDC wants to mandate that if you're traveling in any kind of public transportation, you happen to have a cold or whatever, sniffles, they can stop you for 72 hours and they don't have to release you until they can vaccinate you against the local flu or whatever. Is that true?
Well, it's kind of true. I mean, that isn't exactly the way this is written. There was a policy change that has been put forth to change at the CDC. It was one of a CDC policy. And that this particular policy is an expansion upon the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that was actually released back in 2001. And the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act does pretty much what you described, that it takes away your right to refuse and your ability to walk away from mandatory vaccination. Now, there's nothing in this policy change that says anything about mandatory. But what the policy change is suggesting is that the government, the public health service, has the right to screen people for any signs of illness, and particularly an upper respiratory or some sort of respiratory type of illness that might be suggestive of a flu or a pandemic problem. And at that point, they can offer you a vaccine. And if you refuse the vaccine, they could have the right to quarantine you for up to 72 hours against your will and without the ability to call or contact anybody. You can't call your boss, your spouse, your lawyer, anybody. Of course, you could agree to be vaccinated, but you don't have to be vaccinated, but they can hold you in quarantine if you're not. So to me, it's a little bit like, you know, with the IRS, taxes are considered to be voluntary until, of course, you decide to not volunteer. But the policy change, I mean, I don't know that it's been implemented. They posted it in the Federal Register and requested a period of time for comments. The last time I looked, there were more than 12,000 comments that had been submitted, and all of them were negative. We know of people that went to Washington, D.C. and was actually telling people that were in part of the healthcare committee that this was going on. It was a policy change that had no governmental oversight whatsoever. So it wasn't as though you could just, you know, write a letter to your congressman and ask them to not vote on it, because it wasn't being voted on by anybody that was in political power. It was a policy change. So to my knowledge, it's still under consideration. It hasn't been passed yet, but it couples into the executive order that was just released by President Obama within the last couple of weeks to create this overwhelming, overshadowing public health for the greater good and the greater good of society sort of policy level. In terms of medicating and vaccinating the world. I'm not getting the language exactly right about that, but I encourage everyone to just go look at President Obama's most recent executive order, which is very long. I mean, it's, you know, usually those executive orders are probably in the realm of, you know, under 300 words. This was multiple pages long, creating this great big banner overflow to be able to kind of put into place an overarching, we know best, and if we think you should be vaccinated, we want to have the right to vaccinate you sort of policy.
And do you think that, how much of the, now let me organize my thought. How much of this do you think is being in the shadows, in the dark corners where people meet? How much of this do you think is being pushed behind this is being funded by the fall of the money syndrome?
Oh, well, all of it. I mean, seriously.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, thank you.
I mean, you know, part of the section, one of the heftier sections that I'm working on and writing this new book right now about They're Coming After You Next is laying out this globalist agenda that we have to stop relegating to the garbage bin of nutcases and conspiracy theories where people are running around with aluminum tinfoil hats and thinking that the government is out to get them. And I don't know that they're personally out to get anyone on an individual basis, but, you know, when you look at Agenda 21, which is a global land grab, and when you look at Agenda 2030, which was announced at the UN back about 12 months ago, and Agenda 2030 it takes into every aspect of what you have in your life in terms of your health, your water, your food, I mean, everything, and that they have decided that this is the best thing that can happen to the world is Agenda 2030. And you couple that in with the power, the $1 trillion industry of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and the whole really what I feel is a pretty creepy transhumanism, nanoparticle technology that they want to introduce or is being introduced with a lot of different things. It's an overarching globalist control that is not just a bunch of crazy, kooky conspiracy theorists. I mean, it is really in the plans. You can go online and read it. You can read their entire huge website of the 17 tenets that they plan to control across the entire world. So it's real. It's not somebody that's just crazy and just made something up.
Do you think vaccines are part of population control?
Well, to a certain degree, yes, I do, because we know that the Gardasil vaccine has been shown to cause testicular atrophy in male mice and uterine atrophy and ovarian atrophy in female mice and female mice. And we know that Gardasil is given to teenagers now between the ages of 12 and 14 at the area of time in their life when they're starting to develop their reproductive organs. And, you know, so I believe that there are some real issues with what's happening with Gardasil, which is the vaccine that's supposed to stop cervical cancer, which it doesn't. I know that the polysorbate 80 is also in other vaccines and could cause those types of problems. And so, you know, I mean, it's pretty well known way back from, you know, Bill Clinton's first term in office. And this all came off of the White House website that I was reading the other night from when Bill Clinton was president in 1992. And this entire agenda that they were putting together, the sustainability agenda, and I believe it was a 20-point list of things they wanted to accomplish. And one of those points was stabilization of the population, because as we continue to allow the population to grow, we would outstrip our ability to be able to support the global population in terms of food and water and the whole concept of sustainability.
When we look at the Gardasil shots, and there's controversy there with Dr. Harper saying one thing one time and one thing another, and she's recently come out with something else. I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. But when we decoded the Gardasil shots, and there are four of them that we decoded, we found that the frequencies that they were interfering with in the body, and the body speaks frequency in terms of how things move around, that all four of those dealt with estrogens, progesterones, calcitonin, calcium, things that were needed for fertility. And when people are coming into the clinic here, young women, and they're infertile, we can trace that back to some of those numbers in the Gardasil shot. Just want to bring that in because I think it's horrid. But with Dr. Harper, she's the one that did the original search on Gardasil, and I'm going to talk about California for a minute. She said years ago that it was awful and it wasn't really for cancer.
then she recanted. Now she's come out again and saying her conscience isn't allowing her to put this out there, that Gardasil is really not any kind of cancer cure. Can you enlighten us and tell us the truth?
Well, I can't really, because I don't really know what she said specifically. I do know that at first she did not support, she was one of the original researchers on Gardasil, and it said that there was a lot of problems and that you would have to vaccinate every single child for 3 or 4 generations to prevent the same number of cases of cervical cancer that you could prevent just by doing annual Pap tests. And so, and then I know that she was under a lot of pressure for her job, and I don't know any a lot of the details, but I do know that most people that kind of stand out and stand up and say vaccines are not a good thing, at one time or another, they come into a lot of different pressure. And it wouldn't surprise me that she's changed her mind a couple of times.
Well, she said she needed to clear her conscience. So, okay, thanks.
I have to say, because I see us moving quickly to a close, is that it's really shocking at the idea that it really seems to me, this is my opinion, that public health, the idea of public health, really seems to be really leaning heavily toward corporate profit. First, under the guise of we want to, you know, we know what is going to make you healthier, and it happens to make us a boatload of money. Guys, am I reading that wrong? Please?
Well, you know, this is a big swatch of, you know, what I'm writing in the book is, how do we get to this point? How did we get to the place where public health has its, you know, its nose in every single corner of our life? And how did we go from public health being about, you know, safe water and safe food and safety from, you know, things like falling off of ladders? And how did we get to where that the cornerstone of public health is making sure that everyone is vaccinated? And the profit in terms of public health really isn't public health. It's the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry has become the cornerstone of what we call public health. And we consider the most important thing of public health is that to be vaccinated. I mean, think about it. If your child falls off a bike and you want an x-ray to make to see if they broke their arm, I mean, what is the first thing that they ask and they get all hot and bothered about is what is their vaccination status? You know, you go to the doctor, and I've had patients tell me this all the time. I went to the doctor because of XYZ problem, but all they really cared about was whether or not I had my flu shot or my shingles shot. And so public health in terms of what we lauded it to be back in the 1930s, maybe even moving through the 1960s, is certainly not what we have in 2016.
Wow. And you drop the mic and walk off the stage. I have to ask, what is the, you know, the name of your new book that we all get to look forward to, in quotes?
Well, the working title on it right now is They're Coming After You Next. They're Coming After You Next. Adolescent and adult vaccine mandates. And so that's the working title. And it's interesting because every time I get to the point where I think I'm at, I can start unwinding things, I go down another rabbit hole and find a whole bunch more information that people really need to know about. Like many of the things that we've talked about here on this interview today about electronic medical records, about public health, all about vaccines now. It's really not about health. It's about vaccination status and of all the people that get injured and harmed from vaccines. And so that's something that I'm hoping to make a big dent in terms of information going forward. And that when people understand that they will just get a little bit more information and stand up and just say no. Of once they understand what the vile stuff that's coming out of that vial and being injected into their body, once they understand that health is an inside-out phenomenon, it comes from what you eat, what you drink, what you think, your thoughts, your vibration of your thoughts and your emotions is what health is all about. It's not about injecting you with stuff that more than likely is going to make you sick.
Wow. I'll have to edit out all those wows.
I think you should leave them in.
Okay. All right. More mic dropping and walking off the stage. There are a number of t-shirts here that would be really excellent. Where would you like people? Go ahead.
Well, people need to, because I'm going to have to, unfortunately, because of my technology issues, we're kind of running out of time, and I am going to have to quickly depart here. But if people would join us on Facebook, which is Dr. Tenpenny on Vaccines and Current Events, on Facebook, Dr. Tenpenny on Vaccines. My website that's under construction right now is drtenpenny.com. My medical clinic is in Cleveland, Ohio. It's tenpennyimc.com. It's Tenpenny Integrated Medical Center, so it's shortened up to be tenpennyimc.com. My book's available through our website or through Amazon, and I hope that that people will just get involved. I mean, if you've only got 3 hours a week of your time to commit to something that you're passionate about, then commit those 3 hours a week and do it with 100% vigor, because every cause on the planet needs support. And I think that we are at a tipping point right now that if we really got people involved, we could really make a difference.
I agree. And that was our last question, to ask how people could get in touch with you. And do you actively see clients? How long does it take to get to you?
I see patients 2.5 days a week. I also have 2 nurse practitioners and a physician assistant that have been with me for a long time. And so, I really want to encourage people. And we see people of all ages. We see infants. We have a board-certified pediatrician in our office that does not vaccinate and has not vaccinated children in her entire career. We have, like I said, we do breast thermography in the office. We treat allergies. We do bioidentical hormones. We see men and women of all ages, and we would love to see more patients.
Excellent. An excellent show. Thank you for being here. And certainly when your new book comes out, we'd like to have you back.
Oh, that would be great. And hopefully the next time we won't have the technical difficulties, but it's been a pleasure, and I certainly appreciate being part of your program.
Thank you so much. That was, I now have to lay down. that was really excellent. Thank you. It's all just, just stunning and horrific. That's really where I have to close. It is just stunning and horrific where we're at. How we got here, where we're at, it just blows my mind.
And you are a brave woman to put up with this.
Well, somebody has to do it. It might as well be me.
Perfect. Thank you so much. That's a great close. Thank you.
All right.
Dr. Tenpenny. All right, everybody. There you go. Dr. Tenpenny on fire. I think she's always on fire. There's also a new page on Facebook called Vaccine Choices. You can go to Facebook if you're on Facebook. Go to Facebook and search for Vaccine Choices. And it's a great informational site. I believe it's part of the NVIC organization. And also I know that Dr. Penny posts some information there. They post a lot of current information and they update frequently. So that would be a good place to look. On Facebook, you go and search for Vaccine Choices. And you can ask to join the organization, because they actually kind of vet people as you go in. And once again, if you want to listen to this replay or send it to your friends or family, I would suggest that you go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and then click on the archives tab, and you'll be able to listen to the show in about 15 to 20 minutes. And also you can find all of the shows at iTunes by searching for Sherry Edwards, and or at Pocket Cast, Dog Catcher, any number of podcast aggregators. All right, everybody. After that, go outside in nature. Have a great day. We'll see you on Tuesday. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.